everyone, and welcome into CrushTheStreet.com. I hope you guys are ready to just really have your minds expanded. I have a new guest on the line with me today. His name's Bobby Casey. He's with GlobalWealthProtection.com. Someone who's really broken down some barriers for his own personal life, internationalized himself, and really just looked into what the best structures are for people who want to optimize their finances and, you know, optimize their quality of life and have the most they can, right? You know, if you want to work less or want to work more and have more. I mean, these are all situations that I think we all want to ask ourselves. And he's actually done it. He's a non-apologetic capitalist. He specializes in finance, law, economics. And I think he's going to be able to articulate things that, you know, when it comes to the government, when it comes to our current structure, that might bother us and we might vaguely understand, but just haven't really been able to wrap our minds around fully. So I look forward to having a very thorough conversation, talk to him about people who have internationalized their life. They live in the U.S. I mean, it's, you know, supposedly the number one country in the world, biggest economy, all these different things. But yet he might have some different words, different opinions, and ways that we might be able to optimize our own personal lives. So without any further ado, Bobby Casey, y'all. Bobby, thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, Kenneth, thanks for having me.
Well, I don't want to shortchange your intro at all. If you can, maybe you can give us a little bit of a background as to, you know, how you got to where you are today and, you know, why we're having this call here on January 23rd, 2020.
Sure. Background-wise, I grew up in North Carolina. I was raised in a very conservative southern family, and but I was hardcore, you know, fundamentalist Christian family. Luckily, I escaped those chains. But from that standpoint, I was raised in kind of a closed-minded environment, but fortunately, I was raised by a father who was pretty entrepreneurial. Since I was born, when I was born, my father was a partner in a construction company, and then when I was very young, 3 or 4 years old, he sold out and started another construction company. And then during my childhood, we were the topic of conversation at the dinner table was never about, you know, getting those good grades and getting that college degree and that sort of thing. It was always about business, about, you know, just various entrepreneurial topics. He owned a construction company. He did a lot of real estate development. He owned a lot of real estate, you know, growing up. And so, you know, sitting around the dinner table, we talked a lot about tax minimization, company structure, you know, exciting topics for 13-year-olds to discuss over country-style steak and gravy, right? But nonetheless, it was still things I learned at a pretty young age. I actually opened my first brokerage account trading stocks when I was 14 years old. And I'd started working when I was 12. And I came from a reasonably wealthy family. I mean, we weren't super rich, but for sure upper middle class, let's say. But I still had a father who said, you know, you're still going to work. Like you're not getting a free ride. So I started working when I was 12, saved up a decent amount of money and started trading a little bit when I was 14. And I started a business when I was, I guess I was 18, that failed miserably. I started something else when I was 19 that failed miserably. I started something else when I was 20 that actually slowly took off, but then it did pretty well. We ended up with the company. We ended up hitting a seven-figure mark revenue, a seven-figure mark in just under 3 years. And it was a service business, and I don't need to go into too many details about that unless you really want to discuss it, but it was a service business that I grew to, let's say upper seven figures, not quite eight figures. throughout that period of time through my 20s and early 30s, I ended up buying a few different, I bought a couple of competitive businesses, rolled them in. I ended up buying and selling a restaurant, bought and sold a ton of real estate, and got pretty heavily involved in investing and diversifying my own portfolio. And I guess I was probably early 30s, had my midlife crisis and decided I hated my business, my customers, my employees, and everything about what I was doing for a living. So I sold the business and decided to pursue something that was more interesting for me. And if I rewind back into my late 20s, I came to a point where I had quite a bit of assets between business and real estate, restaurant, and all this other stuff. And asset protection became a topic that was interesting for me. Tax minimization was always an interesting topic for me. But asset protection became more interesting. And so I actually hired a consultant, basically a guy that does exactly what I do now, to help me develop my own asset protection structure. And we became friends. I ended up doing some work with him for the next couple of years, mainly working with some of my friends who were also entrepreneurs, helping them put together asset protection strategies. And then when I sold my company in my, I guess it was it's about 12 years ago now, or something like that. Time goes, it gets a little foggier as time passes, but it's about 12 years ago I sold that company. And I decided when I had this kind of midlife crisis, I sold my company and I said, you know what, I'm going to do something I really enjoy. And I really enjoy having the freedom to basically live and work and, you know, kind of control my own schedule and my own where I want to spend my time. So, and I also enjoyed working with other entrepreneurs. So doing this consulting on company structure and tax minimization and asset protection planning is what I got into at that point. And that was, I guess, 12 years ago, approximately now. And so that's basically what I'm doing now. And that business has kind of evolved. And our tagline now is internationalize your business, your wealth, and your life. Because, you know, I'm a big fan of internationalization strategies, both from a financial standpoint, but also from a personal standpoint. And so for the past decade or so, I've been living in a bunch of different places around the world and helping my clients, mainly location independent entrepreneurs or entrepreneurs with foreign assets and foreign investments, help them with internationalization strategies.
Bobby, I connected a lot with you there. I mean, in terms of, you know, early entrepreneurial minded, you know, buying your first stock at a very young age. You know, I'm sure you have a lot of similar mindsets when it comes to, you know, limited government and, you know, kind of you see the issues that are going on and it bothers you. It bothers you that, you know, you have to give your personal property for things that maybe you don't agree with and whatnot. But I guess, you know, a lot of the people that listen to this show, I mean, they despise the government and, you know,
news.
They're looking for a little more meat than what they might get from Fox or CNN that puts out. But let me set this scenario up for you. If we all, you know, 100 of us got together, we all went to an island and started over, we would organize in some way, I would imagine. And it would be a form of government, right? But we got plugged into the government, you know, 100 years into the current form we have now, right? And it's 330 million people, all this yada, yada, yada. But I mean, I just want to kind of get the understanding of at what point does the snake start eating its own tail? You know what I'm saying? And it just deteriorates and gets to the point where we have this, you know, global issue where governments are just a problem for freedom and sovereignty for us as individuals.
So the snake is already eating its own tail. The snake has been eating its own tail at least for 100 years. Okay. And I would say probably even much, much longer than that. But I could easily trace the snake eating its own tail to about 100 years ago. Now, with that said, I am a philosophical anarchist. I actually don't believe if 100 of us went and landed on an island, I don't think we would organize as a government. I actually believe that regardless of what history has been, and if you think about history beyond the scope of our human narrowly focused myopic vision, where we can't really see past the beginning of our lifespan or the end of it, because most humans are quite myopic in their views, right? If you really look at actual human history, more than 99% of human history has been anarchy, okay? We've really only had government for a few hundred years in any real reasonable form. We lived really until the agricultural age, we lived with zero central authority. Any government actually really only came about, let's say, 10,000 years ago, or any semblance of any organizational structure. And really only the past few hundred years have we had any government. So whether I agree or disagree, it doesn't really matter whether that was necessary or not. The point is, humanity has now evolved beyond the need for government. I think technologically, we have evolved beyond the need for actually having any government. Now, of course, the argument, you know, you always hear that, well, who will build the roads? You know, these kind of silly arguments. When I think about that, like when people say, but who will build the roads? I think about that. Like, imagine you got this huge company out there, Walmart. And imagine Walmart builds a store kind of in the middle of nowhere. And let's imagine you get this huge home builder, Linmar Homes. Let's say they go build this huge neighborhood with 1,000 homes in this huge development. And the idea that without a government, we would never figure out how to put roads between that neighborhood and that Walmart is pretty hilarious to me. Okay. I don't think we need any centralized authority. And I think we've evolved beyond the need for it. Does that mean I think we have all of our problems solved? Does that mean I think everything would be perfect and everything is exactly as it should be? No, of course not. I think we'll definitely have problems. If we shifted to a governmentless society, I think we'd absolutely have problems. The thing is, I think those problems would be minute in comparison to the problems government itself causes.
Fair enough. We have an HOA for a community is an organization, and you know, it's localized, and there's going to be people that are frustrated with what happens in the HOA or not. I mean, obviously it's a choice. You can opt out, you can move, you can leave.
It's a voluntary association, right? HOA is a voluntary association. You don't want to deal with that HOA. You choose not to buy a home there. If the HOA becomes cumbersome and you don't want to deal with it anymore, you sell your house and you move. It's a voluntary association, whereas government is not a voluntary association. I don't have a choice to participate, right? I mean, if you think about it, tell me, Kenneth, how does your business exist? What one thing allows your business to continue to exist?
The desire to deliver.
And
to make money.
Money, right? It's the money. The one thing that allows your business to exist is money. Because if you don't have money, you can't, and I'm not talking about fiat currency. I mean, money in the most basic sense of money. That money could be Bitcoin, gold bars, or seashells. I don't care. I'm just saying in the most basic sense, the thing that allows your business to survive and thrive is money, just like mine. In every other business, if you don't provide a quality product or service to your customers, that they don't pay you money to do whatever it is you do, then you die. Your business dies, right? But how does government exist? It also exists on money, right? But the key difference is government doesn't really exist on providing a quality product or service. It taxes you. You have two forms of it, basically. I mean, simplified. You have two different ways government creates money. It's through inflationary policies, through central banking, and through taxation. Well, taxation, I don't care. I will have this debate till the end of time. But taxation is theft. Income. And when I say taxation, in this context, I specifically mean income tax. And income taxation is theft. There is no way to make a logical argument against income tax as theft. And I'll tell you what I mean. Imagine this. Imagine income tax, the income tax rate is, let's say, an arbitrary 30%. Okay? Now, let's imagine income tax is voluntary, 100% voluntary. And let's say you make $100,000 this year. Now, tell me, on January 1st, do you write that $30,000 check to the government?
Not if it's voluntary.
Not if it's voluntary, right? Who would? I don't care, the most socialist, Bernie Sanders loving, liberal, left-leaning liberal on the face of this planet, come January 1st, when the ink goes to the paper to write that $30,000 check, he's going to say, nah, I'm not going to do it. Nobody
will. I mean, they're giving contributions when they showed their tax returns was pretty telling for their true colors.
Exactly.
When it comes to socialism.
Right. And so then the argument there is, if you wouldn't give the money voluntarily, why do you give it? There's only one reason you do pay that income tax. It's because there is some threat of violence against you. Now, I'm using this as kind of a, let's say, a sensationalistic term. But ultimately, there is a threat of violence. If you don't pay your income tax, ultimately somebody's coming knocking on your door, and potentially you could go to jail, or at a minimum, you have seizures of assets, lien, tax liens on your property, wage garnishment, so on and so forth, right? But there is some major negative consequence against you for non-payment of an income tax. So ultimately, it's a non-voluntary tax payment. Now, if you think about it like this, Ken, if I walk up behind you on the street in Austin, Texas, and I put a gun in your back and I say, open your wallet and give me all your money, am I moral? Of course not. I just threatened you with violence to take, all the money in your back. Now, what happens if I say, hey, buddy, give me all the money in your wallet, but you can keep 20 bucks of it or 30% of it?
Now I'm grateful.
Right. And now, maybe if you, are a Bernie Sanders supporter, you're grateful. But ultimately, I'm still affecting an immoral act upon you, because even though I'm stealing your money and I'm saying, I tell you what, you keep, 70% of it, I only want 30. Or another way to look at it, what if I tell you, all right, man, give me half of your money, but I tell you what, I'm going to donate that money to a children's charity, but I still got a gun in your back. But I'm going to donate that money to a children's charity. How do you feel about it then?
They sugarcoated the pill. I feel like they done the same thing, but they sugarcoated it and sold it differently. And I feel like that's what they do, right? They almost
exactly
they cover up the theft and just talk about the charity that's being done.
Yeah. So you think they tell you, give me, like, I'm the guy with the gun in your back. The fact is, I might be using the money for the best, most moral purpose on earth once I have the money, but the act of taking the money from you is an immoral act because I'm stealing it. And I'm taking away your choice on how you want to spend that money. Maybe you had a different children's charity you wanted to donate to, right? Or maybe you had a cancer research charity you wanted to donate to, or feeding homeless people on Sixth Street or something, right? Like, I'm taking away your voluntary choice of what you do with your money. So my point is, ultimately, when I tax you or when I steal from you, it's no different than being taxed, because it's still a threat of violence against you or a negative consequence for failure to comply. And which makes, to me, income taxation, it makes it ultimately an immoral act. And I don't see any other way to argue against it. Now, you think about other taxes, other types of taxes, you could make a case that they are voluntarily paid. You could say, and this is also an educational issue too, because a lot of people say, yeah, but how do you build the roads and infrastructure if we don't have income tax? Well, the vast majority of all your road and infrastructure funding comes from a fuel tax, right? And your license plate, your tag and taxes on your vehicle. But if you buy gas for your car, if you take a bus to go somewhere, if you get on a plane, all of those things involve a fuel tax, which you voluntarily pay by putting that gas in your car or buying that plane ticket. So in a sense, those taxes are, let's say, a voluntarily paid tax. Now, you could argue that, you know, you wouldn't pay it if you didn't have to, but you still choose to get in your car and put gas in your tank. So in a sense, consumption taxes are somewhat of a voluntary tax, right? You could also say property tax, which primarily funds education within the local area of the county where you live. A lot of people say, but how will we educate the kids? You know, public education, which that's a whole different topic, but how will we educate the kids if we don't pay income tax? Well, income tax is primarily funded through property tax. And you voluntarily choose to live where you do. Even if you're location independent, you voluntarily choose to rent an Airbnb in the town where you're staying, which ultimately results in payment of property tax on that property you're renting, right? So anyway, this is my case against income tax, and I find it to be an immoral act because it's not voluntary. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, and I appreciate that. Let's talk a little bit, you know, in segue from that. You know, okay. Trump is in Davos, Switzerland, and he's talking about refinancing the debt with low interest rates. And he believes that if he can do this and grow the economy and cut taxes and, you know, he can pay it off. I mean, that's his goal, you know.
Pay off government debt?
I mean, he believes that ultimately, I mean, that's the goal, to you know, get in front of this thing. And obviously what we've seen is it increase with him being in office. There was concessions for him growing the military, and then there's bigger government spendings for the Democrats, because that's what they wanted. And, you know, therefore we have these massive increasing deficits going on. But I just want to get your thoughts. I mean, is this an endless cycle here? And what is it leading to from just an economic perspective?
Oh, well, I don't know how you can lower interest rates much further. I mean, they just lowered them, I guess, what, this week, right? I think the Fed funds rate went down to, what was it? I forgot, 1.25 or 1.5? I forgot.
Yeah,
I think it was 1.25, but don't quote me on that. A quick Google search can prove it, I guess. But I know it just lowered this week. How much lower can you go than 1.25?
He wants it competitive. Well, the idea is that in his mind, the U.S. is the strongest economy in the world. So why do we have to pay higher rates to attract capital for our currency than other countries? You know, arguably, we should be able to pay lower rates and people would still buy it because of the status that it has around the world, maybe even negative if other countries are negative in comparison.
Well, that last I read, the Federal Reserve is buying about 60 some odd percent of all Treasury debt issues anyway. So that circles back to your initial statement of the snake eating its tail, right? I mean, when you've got the Federal Reserve buying 2/3 of all U.S. debt being issued, how does that work? Basically, you've got the Fed chairman sitting there creating zeros on a computer screen to buy debt so the U.S. can go pay its bills. And the interest payments on that come from what? Just inflated money supply, right? So where does it all end? I mean, it at some point, it ends in a horrific crash. When? My God, who knows? I mean, Japan's been having, you know, this issue going since what? Early 90s? Like, they've been kind of doing this since the early 90s, so... How much longer can it go? This goes back to my statement that most people are myopic. When it comes to politicians, they're even more so, right? Because all they care about is their current term and at best a reelection campaign. So from a presidential standpoint, the longest time frame any president looks at an economic policy from is 8 years. right? So will we crash? Will we have a horrific crash in the next, well, I guess it's an election year, so let's say 4 or 5 more years? Maybe, maybe not. I think we'll probably see a stock market major correction, recession, possibly a big crash. But as far as a debt crash, in reality, right, the Federal Reserve can always enter zeros on a computer screen. At some point, I mean, nobody wants the debt. I mean, nobody wants it now. I mean, 2/3 of it is bought by the, you know, Federal Reserve anyway, right? I mean, China and Japan used to be the biggest buyers of U.S. debt. Now they've kind of tapered off how much they're buying. So that's fallen dramatically. It used to be, I guess, first and second kept trading places between China and Japan, who is the biggest owner of U.S. treasuries. Now the Federal Reserve is bigger than both of them, last I read. So
that's great.
That's a good question. Who knows how long it can last?
It seems like, you know, there's certain aspects of the Trump presidency that I like, but then there's just clear facts about, you know, how uncontrollable everything is that you just have to step back and go, man, you know. And then the fact that he's, you know, dumping trillions of dollars into the military, expanding that. I mean, that's just how empires ultimately collapse. It's just like getting this blow offs pop and we lose control of the money supply. So I understand those things. And because of that, I mean, I want to ask you, you know, what are your thoughts on cryptocurrencies and gold? And how does it play into even what you do structuring people's wealth, finances, or, you know, their lives? I mean, does it play into that?
So I'm going to answer your crypto. That's funny you bring that up, because I was actually going to transition to that if you didn't. So I'll rewind just a second. I said a few minutes ago that I'm a philosophical anarchist. What I mean by that is I don't see the need or the role for government anymore. However, I also have a 3-digit IQ, so I don't expect that government kind of evaporates in my lifetime anyway. I don't see it as something that happens where we can, you know, live in this anarchy utopia that I would love to happen, but I don't see it, which means I also have to be pragmatic about it, which goes back to my views on internationalization strategies, which for me is a little bit of a geo-arbitrage play where you take advantage of opportunities some countries offer. For example, low cost of living, low tax rates, no CFC rules, no tax on foreign source income, these types of strategies. And so you use one country what it's good for, and you use another country for what it's good for in different ways. And this is kind of a geo-arbitrage play. What I mean by that, you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, that's geographical. I've never heard that. Geo-arbitrage. I like that.
So this is kind of my response to philosophical anarchy is you have to be – I mean, you don't have to be. Nobody's making anybody follow my own philosophy, but – if you follow this type of philosophy, you actually have to kind of take anarchy at the personal level, because I'm not going to go out. I'm not going to go to Washington, D.C. and protest for the evisceration of government. I'm not a martyr. I don't need that. I got better things and more productive things to do with my life than that, right? I'd rather go upstairs in my house and go make myself a ribeye and have a glass of bourbon, to be honest. So. I'm not going to waste my time doing these things. But what I will do is take steps to minimize my influence and my connection, or the government's influence and connection into my life. So I think it's perfectly reasonable to think that you can be 90 or 95% anarchist, but still be pragmatic about it, as long as you structure your business and your life in such a way that makes that possible. So
good words.
That makes a great segue into what you just asked me about cryptocurrency. Now, you also mentioned gold or other precious metals. I definitely think from an investment perspective, there's a place for precious metals in your account. But I don't think it is the future of money. I think it is the history of money. And historically, gold and silver, also copper, have been money for a very long time. but it's not practical. It's not practical to use. You live in the US, Texas. I live in Europe. If I needed to hire you for some services, I'm not going to FedEx you a gold coin to pay for your services. It just doesn't make sense, right? It's just not a practical use of money. I'm not going to go down to the butcher and buy my ribeye with a sliver of gold, right? Or silver for that matter. It's just not a practical use. But it can be a hedge against, you know, other currency risk. It can be a piece of your portfolio for a hedge. Now, my view on precious metals is, again, this is only my personal view, so take it with a grain of salt. My view is keep it in your safe, at home, hidden, and don't tell anybody about it, okay? Don't put it in a metal storage facility. I know I have walked through storage facilities both in Switzerland and Panama. I still wouldn't keep my precious metals in a storage facility. I think you have third-party risk there. You also have a privacy risk when you put your money there or metals there. And you know, your third-party risk. What happens if that storage facility goes out of business? What happens if, you know, somebody storms the building and steals all the coin out of it? You still have that risk at home, but if nobody knows it's there, why is somebody going to break into your safe at home, right? So if you're going to have metals, my view is keep it somewhere private in a safe that you control and just don't tell anybody about it, okay? Or, okay, maybe tell your estate planning attorney about it, right? But that's it. That's my view on metals. Keep it under your control, under your thumb. Cryptocurrency. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, that's good. I mean, and you know, I know I speak with people who may feel a little differently than you on that.
Sure.
I mean, it's point well taken. You know, again, it's about really getting the full picture. And I think a lot of people, you know, they get so polarized in one view that they cannot. Even now getting into cryptocurrency, there's so many people who are just gold. They can't open their minds to maybe what you're about to say in cryptocurrency.
And so, no doubt.
It's good to be able to absorb things, kind of find the truth and you know, what's best for you and what's likely to happen. What are the masses likely to do? What's likely to happen going forward? Where are the buyers going to be and where are the sellers going to be? And you know, you obviously want to be in front of the buyers. So anyways, keep going.
When it comes to cryptocurrency, mark this on your calendar. Take my phone number down. Put it on your Google calendar to call me. 10 years from today, it will be a novelty to have a bank account. 10 years from today, it will be a novelty to have a bank account. Write it down and call me and feel free to give me all the shit you want 10 years from now if I'm wrong. But 10 years from today, there'll still be banks. They will be heavily involved in blockchain technology. They have no choice. All the banks are already investing heavily in blockchain technology, all the big ones anyway. But 10 years from now, it'll be a novelty to have a bank account, though. It'll be something people are going to look back on it and think, man, remember? It's like today. Man, remember when we used to put those AOL disks in our computer to get internet? Yeah. It'll be like that.
Or landlines.
Yeah. Remember when we used to
have cell phones?
Yeah. Yeah. Remember when we used to have phones at home? Oh, you're so old, right? And that's what it's going to be like. Right now, the problem with adoption of crypto is not the validity of crypto. It's not even the trust in crypto. Okay. The only issue with crypto right now is the ease of use for grandma. That's it. Grandma would still rather pull out her checkbook at the grocery store than try to figure out how to use some technological device. But guess what? As the population ages, you know, I'm 45 years old. I am pretty technically savvy. Now, I'm no Linux system administrator or anything, but I'm pretty technically savvy. I can use crypto very easily. And 10 years from now, I'm going to be 55. I'm not going to get dumber in the next 10 years. So
maybe 75 to 85.
Maybe, but that population, but that older population kind of phases themselves out of the marketplace. The other thing is,
no offense against grandma and grandpa on that one, guys.
Well, no offense. Yeah, I'm not trying to be offensive either, but if I'm 70 years old, I don't really care to learn some new technology. What do I care? Like, it's not interesting to me. I wasn't raised with this type of technology, and I'm certainly not transitioning into it. But if I'm 20 or 30 or 40, I was absolutely raised in, you know, the internet age, right? And so I can easily make this transition. And what will happen is you've got some products and services, and they get better. Like, it's like every month something new and better comes out. But it gets better. You wait until somebody like Google Pay or Apple Pay implements a cryptocurrency payment in your wallet. And then everybody's going to be paying with Litecoin for their Starbucks coffee. Okay? It's happening. I mean, it absolutely, you can't unring this bell. Crypto will take over fiat currency as the primary currency. We are definitely going to have some struggles up and down with this. You've got some issues. Obviously, you got volatility issues with crypto because, hey, today's Bitcoin is whatever it is, $8,000-some. Tomorrow's $9,000. The next day it's $7,000. We definitely have some volatility issues with crypto, but that's just early adoption phase. We're still in relatively early adoption phase of crypto. That once you've got, let's say 5 billion people using it, it smooths itself out. I mean, we still have volatility, some volatility between, you know, currency exchange, right? I mean, look at something like the euro to the South African rand, right? I mean, it sees big swings. And that's because you have low levels of adoption of some smaller currencies, ultimately. And so people take it, they don't take it.
Bobby,
so once we have the adoption, we get past this.
I love it. And really, you know, like something like precious metals, right? I mean, they've had 5,000 years for the world to discover its price. I mean, this is 10 years into this experiment, and it's continuing to prove itself each and every day. And it's proving itself to be very resilient. So I'm with you 100% on that. Not going to make any predictions here, but my goodness, we've had quite the conversation already. I wanted to ask you a little bit about what you do, how you help people, who do you work with? And maybe you can give us a little bit of an idea on who comes to you, how they benefit, and just maybe an interesting example of, you know, how this could work for, you know, that typical person that might consider that. I'm sure there's a million and one ways to slice and dice it depending on your one specific situation. But, you know, give us a little bit of an idea of what you do and how it's helping people.
So my primary business is global wealth protection. As you mentioned earlier, globalwealthprotection.com. A lot of information on there. We've been writing a blog now for 12 years. We have at least one or two articles a week for 12 years. We've got a lot of information about different products and services we offer, different things we can do, a lot of videos and stuff like that. And our primary, you could say our tagline is internationalize your business, your wealth, and your life. We work primarily with location independent entrepreneurs and investors and it's a narrow niche. I get it. It's primarily location independent, but it is a growing niche. These are people. These are not necessarily your full on digital nomad guys who, you know, 25, 30 year old single guys who live in Thailand for 2 months and live in Bali for 3 months and then go live in Brazil for 3 months. Those are some of my clients also, but they can also be people that just want to maybe move abroad and become an expat, or maybe they just want to internationalize a piece or some of their business or some of their wealth abroad. Maybe they're looking to invest in foreign real estate, establish a second residency in another country, maybe go for a second citizenship in another country. Maybe they want to do some stock or option or other type of investment trading on foreign markets that are not accessible in the US. Maybe they're looking to have some privacy within the, you know, what they do. I also work with a lot of high net worth people when it comes to establishing trust in private interest foundations, that type of thing. So let's probably what would be helpful here would be kind of a mini case study, if that's okay with you.
Absolutely.
So take, for example, is your primary audience American?
Mostly, but it's international. I mean, mostly North American, I would say.
Okay. So let's say you've got an American or maybe Canadian, whatever, who has an online business. Maybe he's has a very successful business selling on Amazon or Shopify or both, or he has his own store. And he's making good money. He's got some assets. He's got some passive income. And he says, you know what? I really want to kind of be on somewhere on the spectrum between expat and digital nomad. And what I mean by that, expat is defined as somebody who lives outside of their country of origin, whereas on the other end of the spectrum is somebody who kind of doesn't live anywhere and just kind of floats around a month or two at a time in different places. So he can be all the way at that end, or maybe he just wants to move to a different country and live for some period of time, or he could be somewhere in the middle of that spectrum. Like me, I have three home bases and I travel quite a bit between them. And so that person just doesn't know how to properly structure his business because there's huge tax advantages for him to not live in his country of origin, whether it's Canada or the US. Canada, structuring for a Canadian is quite a bit easier than for an American. Americans takes a bit more effort and strategic planning because of the different laws between the two countries, but there are some still opportunities. But you take an American who makes $150,000 a year and wants to go spend, you know, a portion of his life living, you know, in other countries. He could easily, if he properly structures his business, he could easily live tax completely or very close to tax free. Okay. So imagine he's making $150,000 a year and he pays roughly 30% in tax. So right off the bat, that saves him $50,000 just to change his lifestyle a bit. Now, I work with clients to help them structure that business so that they can take advantages of this, because there's not a lot of people that do what I do. You go to your local accountant or CPA, they don't really understand exactly these strategies because they're more geocentric. They understand maybe U.S. law, IRS law, maybe their state, whatever state they're in. Or in Canada, maybe they only understand provincial or federal law in Canada. Whereas I understand the principles on how to minimize the tax burden in that country and take advantage of these other opportunities in other countries and where to establish personal residency, where to structure your business, how and where to structure asset ownership and take advantage of these type of things. Okay.
So good. Well, one more thing. I mean, I got to ask, sure. I got three kids, young age. We were kind of talking about this before the interview. I mean, are you seeing people completely uproot their lives, you know, and change what is normal? Because I think that's what's scary. And I think you told me the two biggest reasons is I can't uproot my family and I can't afford to internationalize my life. So maybe address that as
okay.
We close out this interview here. And
I'll address them in reverse. Okay. So the question, I can't afford to do it. Like I hear this all the time. Man, that is cool what you're doing. That's great. Man, it's always been my dream to go live in Italy, for example. And I just can't do it. I can't afford to move to Italy. Well, the thing is, if you have a high income job that's geocentric to exactly the place where you live, and if you quit that job, you lose 100% of your income. Yeah, maybe you can't afford it, right? But nowadays, more and more people, even with traditional jobs, more and more people are going to their employers and saying, hey, can I work remotely? Can I work from home? Maybe come into the office once a month or every 3 months or something like that. And lots of people are doing this now. I remember a couple of years ago, somebody told me that most of the reservation agents for JetBlue work from home. And I thought, that's crazy. Like, that is just not something you think of as a work from home type job. And I had to buy a plane ticket on JetBlue. So instead of normally I go online and buy my ticket, I actually called them because I wanted to talk to somebody, see if it was true. And it was true. Lady on the phone told me, she goes, yeah, she got the job with JetBlue. She's sitting in her home office in Salt Lake City, Utah. And she went out for training at JetBlue's headquarters, and they sent her home with all the technology equipment and to plug in at home. And they have a phone, a desktop phone system that plugs into the internet that puts her into the phone tree of JetBlue's phone system. So while she is working on the clock, it puts her in the phone system. And I thought it was fascinating that, you know, even big companies with, like, I'm not going to say low-level employees, but let's say medium to low-level employees, even those companies are letting their employees work from home. So if you have the ability to work and make your money remotely or without a geographical boundary, then the only financial limitation you have to living abroad is yourself. It's all a mental thing, because I've done the math on this before. There's a lot of tax incentives for Americans to not live in the U.S. And so ultimately, when you factor in some tax incentives, some other savings you get and other things like that, in most parts of the world, now I say most, obviously places like Oslo, Norway, or London, or Singapore, Hong Kong, Sydney, Australia, places like that, those are very high cost of living places, Zurich. Those places, yeah, those are not going to be cheap places to live. But you could live someplace like, let's say, Lisbon, Portugal, or Valencia, Spain, you know, or even some parts of Italy. You can live at less than half the cost of what you're paying in the U.S. When you factor in tax savings of living abroad plus your cost of living savings, you basically take a $100,000 salary and you move it to someplace like Lisbon, and you can live there at the same or better quality of life on $50,000. Now, you have two options there. You can continue to make 100 and double your quality of life, or you can work half as much with the same financial quality of life, but have a lot more time on your hands. So you end up with some additional options there, okay? So that's just on the financial question. I think it's usually an excuse that people make to themselves to not overcome their own objections. On the kids' side, this does get a little bit more complicated. But I did it. I guess 11 years ago. I moved with my kids abroad. And I'll tell you what I told myself. Because I had a lot of this feedback from family, like, oh my God, I can't believe you're moving to another country with your kids. You'll ruin their lives. You're going to ruin their education, and so on and so forth. To me, My response to that is, I can't afford to not give my kids that experience. Because we live in a more globalized world. And if I don't give my kids the experience of living in another country, experiencing other cultures and languages, I'm actually not giving them advantages I could give them by doing that. And so for me, I just kind of flipped the script on myself and said, I can't afford to not give that to my kids. Okay. I can tell you right now, my daughter, I'm not going to mention her name actually, but it's probably not that hard to find. Because I moved to Europe with my kids 11 years ago, my daughter decided when she turned 18 to move to London for her music career. She would never have moved to London if we didn't live in Europe. And she would not have signed a major record deal and a major publishing deal with one of the biggest music companies in the world right now if it wasn't because I did that. So I'm not taking credit for it, obviously. She put in a ton of work. But the opportunity for being and living in Europe and her having the comfort and the let's say courage to go out on her own at 18 years old to pursue her dreams. I don't think she would have done that if we hadn't have uprooted and moved to Europe when she was a teenager.
I'll just add to that right there. It's so true. And I feel like you were touching on really challenging yourself and expanding your horizons. I mean, I know people still to this day, friends of ours, who are still afraid to, you know, getting in their car and getting on the highway. They just stay in their little world. And I just remember how powerful it was when we first moved out of where we grew up from. You know, we bought our first house, you know, close to where I was born. And then when I moved to Texas, I mean, it was just such a growing experience to get beyond the boundaries that we've had for ourselves and to experience life in somewhere else and deal with new challenges and tell yourself and realize that you can do it. You know, and the things that come, the opportunities, the benefits, the challenges, and the experience that you get from just putting yourself in new areas of life. I mean, I just can't speak enough to that. And my goodness, the experience that you've done, living all over the world, you know, doing life with in other countries, speaking different languages. I can only imagine the sort of resilience that that's given you throughout the years. So it's really interesting. And my goodness, what a amazing call we just had. Bobby, thank you so much for coming on Crush the Street with me today. If people want to learn more about you and the work you do, please let them know a little bit more about your site and what they can expect to find.
GlobalWealthProtection.com is our main website. You can find pretty much everything there. We've got a lot of information on the site for people looking to internationalize their business, their wealth, their life. Stuff about company formation, trust and private interest foundation structures. A lot of information on there. We even have a membership program on there where members can join and they get access to our private content. Plus they get free consultations as members. Access to our conferences. We do one entrepreneurship conference every year coming up in April, actually in Arizona. And then we do one mastermind event a year, but only for people that attend our conference. Basically, we do an entrepreneurship conference in April. And then if you attend that, you get invited to our mastermind event. We do, like last year, we did a really cool mastermind event on an island in Panama, where we were basically in a jungle on a jungle island in Panama with about 15 people for our mastermind. It was pretty crazy. But you know, you bring 7 and 8 figure entrepreneurs together for a week. We get shit done.
Good stuff. Well, Bobby, Casey, everyone, Bobby, thanks so much for coming on Crush the Street with me today.
All right, Kenneth, thanks for having me. Have a good day.